Welcome to The Point. I'm Indy Todd. Today, it's bird news with Mark Faraday, science coordinator at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning.
All right, so I guess seabirds are where it's at right now. All kind, you know, it's funny how colorful some of these seabirds we see in the winter are. Some really beautiful birds.
Yes. I mean, they're just amazing in so many ways. I mean, they're not like colorful and gaudy or anything like that, but you know, in their way, they're fantastic. And I'm watching some right now. I'm on location here at Long Pasture Sanctuary, not the usual place I do my show. And from where I'm sitting, I can see Barnstable Harbor whipped up by the wind. Mm. And I need to get out my binoculars to see if there's any shearwaters or anything interesting out there. And this time of year, the diversity of birds that you can see on the water is just incredible. I think it peaks right now because you have the last of the summer birds, right? There's still mm-hmm. four species of shearwater being seen, which are these birds that come from the kind of the four corners of the globe to be here in summer, feed in these rich waters around Stellwagen Bank and elsewhere, but they're still out there. They seem to stay a little bit later every year. Normally, they're going back, you know, some species are going back to the southern hemisphere for their summer. Others go back to the Mediterranean. But they're all still around. At least two species of terns are still around. Those are summer birds that haven't quite left yet. Most of them have, but you can still see common terns and Forster's terns. And then all the winter stuff is in, all the fall and winter stuff, all the three species of scoters and eiders and mergansers. And some of the alcids are coming in, razorbills are coming in, and grebes, and two species of loons, three species of loons when you count Pacific loon, which you can see at Race Point in Provincetown increasingly, and other places on the Outer Cape now. So it's a really exciting time to be watching the water. And the gannets. Mm. The gannets have been incredible.
Lots of them, right? A lot of them.
Yeah, especially there was a couple of week period, especially where the bay was just full of gannets and elsewhere too. That looks like a shearwater right there.
Bird watching while you're doing the bird show.
It's a really unusual thing, and it's just the wind has blown one into Barnstable Harbor. I'm kind of shooting from the hip because I don't have my binoculars, but you can tell them at a long distance because those are definitely either greater or Cory shearwaters I'm seeing right now from inside a building. So that's pretty. This is a bird you should be in a boat to see, and I'm like naked eye here.
I've seen it, and you didn't mention the buffalo heads. We're seeing buffalo heads now too. I love. They're so cute. What do you think about the buffalo? Do you like buffalo heads too?
Do I like? No.
No, I don't like.
I don't like them at all. Yeah. Who doesn't like buffalo?
I was going to say, who doesn't like them? They're so cute.
You'd have to be. What sort of monster doesn't like? Well, I can think of some, but most normal people like buffalo heads, right? I mean, they're adorable. They're like little rubber ducky mm-hmm. ducks, but they're tough as nails. They come in from further north. They nested in a cavity somewhere in probably Canada. And then they come down here for the winter. And they're so adaptable. They could use any kind of water body. They're on, you know, saltwater bays, salt ponds, freshwater ponds of all sizes. Like just about any body of water will have a buffalo head on it starting around now through mm-hmm. the winter.
Yeah.
Probably the most widespread duck we have. And they're just and they're cool looking. So yeah, they're in. I know a lot of people look forward to buffalo head time.
Exactly.
It's more so than the juncos, like they come in a little bit after the juncos. And when people see the juncos, they're like, damn it.
Where's
you know,
the buffalo?
Winter's coming. I think that the juncos are, you know, you sort of accept that winter's coming once the juncos settle in.
Yeah.
And then by the time the buffalo heads get here, you're just glad to see them.
It's like, oh buffalo heads. What about the long-tailed ducks? Are we seeing any, you know, like increasing numbers of the long-tailed ducks?
Massive decrease. It's not really clear why. I don't know if there have been any recent breakthroughs on that, but you know, the massive flights of commuting long-tailed ducks, you know, from Nantucket Sound over to the shoals and back, it is a thing of the past in terms of the really big numbers.
That's too bad.
I never even got to see it.
Oh, I did. Unbelievable.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. Yeah. It looked like tunnels of smoke going through the sky. They were just, thousands and thousands. You couldn't even count them.
Yes.
Yeah, it was amazing. Yeah.
Right.
We should tell people.
And there's such a cool duck. I mean, just seeing one long-tailed duck is a treat because they're so interesting looking.
Yeah.
Just the color pattern, that long pointed tail. These don't look like other ducks. They're kind of small, interesting life history, eating like zooplankton in the kind of mid levels of salt water. They're just interesting ducks, and I really hope we can figure out what's going on.
Yeah, it'd be great to have that back. I want to tell people the phone number in case they want to tell us what they're seeing or they have a question this morning. 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We're often talking about how people need to go out to Race Point or something to see some of these seabirds, and now there's lots of places you can see these birds you're talking about, right?
Yes. The bay has been very good. You don't have to make the trek all the way out to Race Point, first encounter or even, like Duck Harbor and Wellfleet or somewhere around there can be very good. Lots of loons and grebes off of there. And then, it was Sunday. We went up to Provincetown and we were going to go to the Provincetown Library and some other things, with the kids. And we parked to go to the Provincetown Library. And I have my binoculars. I'm scanning Provincetown Harbor. And I see a shearwater, just like I'm seeing here in Barnstable Harbor, way in from where they normally are. It was inside the breakwater right along the harbor beach. I'm like, oh. And I scan, and there are just shearwaters all along, all through the harbor, and then down south along the Truro Bayshore, just shearwaters. Not a bird you expect, like, oh, I'm going to go to the Cape in mid-November to see lots of shearwaters. It's just not what you would expect, but they're still around. The bay temperature is still 56 degrees, as my sea turtle crew well knows, because they're just sort of sitting around twiddling their thumbs, waiting for sea turtles to strand, because that happens when the bay temperature gets below 50. But it's still like 55 degrees, the bay.
Hmm.
And that's been the trend, right? That just stays warmer. Hmm. Later.
Longer, yeah, yeah. So you also had this great encounter, as you talked about in your bird report, with the dolphins. So for folks who didn't hear, tell us about that. That sounded pretty amazing.
Yes, and now I'm wondering if that pod was the one that sort of seemed to break apart and strand on a whole bunch of different bay beaches over the last several days, or over a several-day period. And so, yeah, we stopped at Skakit Beach. It was last Monday. There was no school in a couple of different school districts. And so it was me and my son, Beckett. We Skakit Beach. I was kind of scanning. I was like, wait a minute. What are those splashes out there? That's not gannets. What are those dorsal fins? And it was a big pod of dolphins. And it was far enough out that if you weren't scanning with binoculars, you would have had no idea. They were probably 3 miles out. But I had my scope and put them in the scope, and Beckett got to look at them. There might have been 100 of them or more. It's hard to count them.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just such a cool thing to see. It's, I spent a lot of time looking at the water, but I'm not seeing dolphins every day. So that was a real treat. And then about, several days later, there were like little strandings on a bunch of different bayside beaches from, I think, Dennis to Orleans, at least. East Ham.
Yeah. Yeah.
But IFA was on the scene and
doing their thing,
rescued the ones they could. Yeah.
Yeah. It's funny. This was several years ago, pre-COVID. I can't remember how much before that. I was out with Stormy Mayo from Center for Coastal Studies. We were looking, doing some right whale research reporting with Stormy. And as we were kind of tooling out there get up to this one whale they were looking for, all of a sudden, out of nowhere, hundreds, and I mean hundreds of dolphins. I just never think of that happening here, And it was like this magical moment that I will never forget. And Stormy was like, too bad we're not counting dolphins today. But it was just unbelievable that just how they just kind of appeared and, and then they were gone. But yeah, very cool.
Yeah. Always a treat when dolphins show themselves to you, especially if you're in a boat.
Yeah.
I've seen some people and there's just been a lot around this year. And I don't know what's going on in the bay. A lot of dolphins, a lot of Manx shearwaters hanging around in the bay. Not sure what's going on with fish, but you know, people posting those videos and, oh, here we are just cruising along in our boat with a bunch of bow riding common dolphins. Such a treat.
All right. So let's talk about something we don't see here often. Barn owl nest. We found a barn owl nest on the Upper Cape.
Yeah. Two different ones.
Two. Yeah.
And I'll say Falmouth. I think there are populations that are on, we know barn owls we associate with Martha's Vineyard and Nantucket. And that's anywhere else anymore is unusual, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, there used to be barn owls in the Connecticut River Valley and other parts of Massachusetts, but they just retreated to the islands and that's the last place that they're nesting. But they seem to be making inroads. And this was some really good evidence that there's probably a lot more out there that we don't know about, because two different places in Falmouth that I didn't know about. I think some they'd been nesting there for multiple years. Mm-hmm. One, you know, an old barn, and one is a business, like just a kind of a weird place, mm-hmm. like a warehousey kind of business. One came to light because a chick fell out, and that chick is being cared for at Cape Wildlife Center. You might remember there was a nest in Yarmouth several years ago and the barn collapsed. Mm-hmm. And then I think maybe the entire brood of chicks ended up at Cape Wildlife Center. And I think they got released. And then, you know, other evidence that they're dispersing from the islands and trying to establish themselves elsewhere is a dead one washed up or ended up on Nauset Beach in Orleans with a band from Nantucket. So it had been mm-hmm. banded as a chick on Nantucket. And, you know, that's a good flight for a barn owl. Yeah. got itself all the way to Nauset and then didn't make it. And I think there are other places where barn owls might be nest. So if you have an old barn, especially if it's near any kind of grassland, you know, they like open areas. Mm-hmm. They're a little versatile in terms of where they like to be, but they tend to like open areas, you know, like the moors of Nantucket and big salt marshes and grassy farms and that kind of thing. Yeah. They're really common in agricultural areas in other parts of the country, like,
but not that much.
Florida and California.
And all owl faces seem to be very pretty, but they're just the sweetest face that they have.
Yeah, the heart-shaped face.
Yeah.
And barn owls are all over the world. I think they've split them up into kind of different species, but barn owls they're in Africa and Asia. They're a cosmopolitan bird, and they're really important. You know, they have a high metabolism. They eat pretty much entirely rodents and shrews, rodents and rodent-like things, and they eat tons of them. And so they're great to have around if you're a farmer. But I worry about them with rodenticides because of their high metabolism and the number of rodents they eat. Mm. I wonder if that will hold them back, and maybe they could have colonized the mainland, you know, a lot longer ago if it wasn't for these widespread anticoagulant rodenticides, these rat poisons that people use that are in those little black bait stations boxes, that you see around businesses and things. And, you know, those things are pumping out these half-dead rodents that then something like a barn owl or a bald eagle has happened multiple times eats. And if they eat enough of them, then, you know, they can die. It's like they're overdosing on Coumadin, right? It's like accidentally took your whole bottle of Coumadin, you probably wouldn't do very well. And that's what was happening to these raptors.
Yeah, so sad. Yeah. All right, 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. And we'll have more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. It's Bird News This Morning with Mark Faraday, Science Coordinator at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary. 866-999-4626 is our number for your bird comments, questions, stories. And as always, we'll talk about other animals. 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. One thing that people always look forward to in the winter is spotting a snowy owl. And we haven't had any the last couple of winters. So any ideas of, you know, looking at where they're breeding, any idea whether we might see any this winter?
Yeah, that's a big question. I can't think of a time when we've gone 0-2 in two winters. Maybe one snowy owl over the last two winters. And there's almost always one or two, even if it's not a big year. And it's certainly not, you know, the big years don't come all that often, but every year there's usually a few in the primo spots, like the tip of Sandy Neck, the tip of Nauset Beach. These, they really like the ends of barrier beaches where they can hunt ducks at dusk, you know, and other things. But really just none. And it all comes down to breeding success in Arctic Quebec. And I checked in with some folks associated with that work, and there was some breeding success, but they don't really have all the tea leaves to predict whether we're going to see any. You know, some breeding success sounds good, better than the last couple of years. And so if there's a really good breeding year with lots of lemmings, and then it all comes down to the lemming cycle. So these little, you know, they're a good size, they're like almost guinea pig size rodents that determine so much in the Arctic in terms of predator diets, you know, from snowy owls to Arctic foxes to skuas.
You got your binoculars now.
That's right. You can see me. I get the big flock of scoters just went by. I'm waiting for those shearwaters to come back. So the lemming populations are on a cycle. If you get a big lemming year, that means lots and lots of baby snowy owls survive, which means we see them. And they're not starving. You know, it's just the old myth. They're starving. The snowy owls are starving. Like, no, I mean, Bonaparte skulls. There's a flock of about 40 Bonaparte skulls and a Manx shearwater going by right now. I cannot believe how good the seabirding is for my office. And there's two...
Maybe this is why they don't put you in this office all the time, Mark.
Yeah.
Oh, you won't get any work done.
Everywhere. There's shearwaters everywhere.
All right.
Anybody, Barnstable Harbor, people should be, you know, I can't imagine what it's like. Imagine Corporation Beach is very good right now. I'm not even sure what the wind direction is, but this is really unusual.
I'm going to go to the phones because we got people hanging on ready to talk. Linda's calling. Linda's calling from Falmouth. Hi, Linda.
Hi. Well, I will say I'm sitting right next to Falmouth Harbor at this very moment, and there is not a single duck anywhere. Mm. And normally there would be buffleheads and all the, you know, whatever. And living mergansers just hang here. There's not a duck anywhere in sight. But that's not my question. What do ducks eat? I mean, you see the diving ducks and the different ones. Do they eat fish? Do they eat plants? You know, what are they eating in the water?
There goes a gannet, an adult gannet. They eat bread.
No, they don't, do you know? Not. Don't say
you
that.
You got to get down to the pond
that.
And give them bread.
Yes,
or the ducks will,
yes. Uh-uh. You're, don't, we don't want to give them
die.
Bread. Yeah.
Give
they're going to die
I'm
if
just,
you give
I'm
them
just,
the bread.
Oh, my
I
Lord.
The
they're just sheer water.
And I see the people standing at Surf Drive all winter throwing loaves of bread into the parking
no,
lot.
Good
yeah,
God.
No.
It's so dumb. No, don't do that.
Yeah.
No. It's
right, just, so what do they eat?
No, I know. What do they eat? It depends on the duck. There are fish-eating ducks. There are dabbling ducks that eat a lot of vegetation that they either pick off the bottom of a pond or scruffle around in the mud in the bottom of a pond. Or there are ducks that filter the water. You can see teal doing this. They have these lamellae, these sort of comb-like structures where they're filtering little organisms and plants out of the water. You know, as a group, they eat everything you can imagine from, okay. You know, the roots and corms of underwater plants, seeds of things like smart weeds. And
well,
and
I
then the mergansers are specialized ducks with the, you know, a serrated bill. They're almost like a little dinosaur bird, and they swim around and eat fish, crayfish, things like that. Buffleheads eat a lot of snails and clams and things. Yeah. And then eiders, okay. the big sea ducks tend to specialize on shellfish and crabs. They like a good, they like a crunchy diet. Scoters and eiders.
I see them in the canal. I see the eiders a lot at the canal, but I never see them with anything in their beaks, you know, and I wonder, are they just filtering plankton or are they actually eating fish? Or I never see them.
No, if you watch them long enough, Chatham Harbor is a good place. But if you watch eiders long enough, they'll bring up like a cluster of blue mussels or a green crab.
Mm-hmm.
Even the loons are eating the green crabs. Loons are eating fish
primarily. Sometimes you'll see them wrestling with a flounder that's a little too wide for their throat.
That's what I'd love to see. Yeah. I see the seagulls.
Yeah.
Yeah. Keep watching.
Yeah,
keep
Linda,
watching.
Thanks for the call.
Another quick question.
Okay, go ahead.
I have had such a rodent population in my gardens and yard, particularly chipmunks. This year, I have had raptors, and it's taking care of the rodent population, the chipmunks, which is just unbelievable how 1 year cycle.
Yeah, Linda, thanks for the call, Linda. I told you that happened a few years ago when there was a red-tailed hawk nest in one of my neighbor's yard. We didn't have any rabbits that summer. All right, Jessica's calling from Wellfleet. Hi, Jessica.
Hi, I'm calling in because I have recently built a new home, and the land got, cleared. So I'm looking to replant, and I was wondering what plants would be key to returning, like, songbirds and bug-eating little birds to the property. And I'm also looking for some key plants that might attract wood ducks because they're my husband's favorite.
Oh, good. Yeah, these are great questions. So what do you have for existing trees and shrubs on the property? Do you know?
Yes, I have a lot of the pitch pine, and then I have actually a substantial stand of mature red oak. So we left
Perfect.
Off everything we could leave. Yeah,
that's the most important first step. There's so much bird food and what you left right there. And then you can build from there and always start with trees and shrubs because you get the most bang for your buck. And, those tend to support the most of the little caterpillars that the birds are feeding their babies. And oaks support the highest diversity of caterpillars of any plant group in North America. And this is from the work of Doug Tallamy and his grad students out of the University of Delaware. It's gotten a lot of publicity. Oaks, willows are tough to grow. If you have a wet backyard with willows already, make sure you leave them. They're not that easy to add as landscaping plants, but cherries, birches, willows, and oaks are sort of the big four in terms of supporting lots and lots of caterpillars, which then naturally support birds that are feeding their chicks. And then, then you can have fun with some of the good landscaping shrubs that support bees, caterpillars, and birds in multiple ways. Things like winterberry, chokeberry, mulberry, any of the fruiting shadbush, viburnums, highbush blueberries. So these things are, they do so many things for you and for wildlife. So they're supporting all these little dormant caterpillars that then when the flowers bloom in the spring, those caterpillars come out and that's what birds are looking for. Then the flowers support spring bees, native bees, all the 3,000 species of native bees in the eastern U.S. And so you're supporting those bees. Those bees are pollinating the flowers. Those flowers then turn into fruit that the birds can eat, depending on the species, either mid to late summer, if you're talking about if you can find a native mulberry, you have to mail order it, or a shad bush. They start eating those in summer, viburnum late summer when they're fattening up for migration. And then through winter, if you're talking about winterberry and chokeberry. So you're getting those flowers, leaves and flowers that support the caterpillars, flowers that support the bees, fruits that support the birds summer through winter. You can't go wrong with a lot of some of these native small trees and shrubs, and there's a longer list certainly.
How exciting though to have this blank canvas that now you can create.
Yes.
Oh, that's so exciting.
And if you have bigger spaces where you can do a seed mix, there are some great ones you can do. There's like a Northeastern pollinator mix that anyone can order from Ernst Seed Company, and it's going to be it's different than some of the ones you get. Like people are like, oh, I got this pollinator mix. And it's all these like non-native annuals and things, poppies and, cosmos and things. But if you do one of the proper native ones, it takes a few years to get it established. There are things that flower the first year. and the second year, but it does take time to establish these native seed mixes, and they'll be heavy on little bluestem. So you're sort of mimicking the natural dry grasslands around here, but they do include milkweeds and things like lanceleaf coreopsis and penstemons and things that also
options,
come up.
Yeah.
So you could do like a native meadow. And they look fantastic.
Yeah,
you know, someone, someone who likes kind of homeowners association living, sort of Stepford, you know, backyard, like, the people that have the T-square out, making sure they have a crisp edge between their lawn and their mulch or whatever, you know, they're not going to like a native meadow, but I love that aesthetic. I think it's catching on more and more.
Oh, thank goodness.
It's great for wildlife. It's no maintenance once you establish it.
Jessica,
and then last is have fun in your border gardens. You know, try to do at least half native perennials. You know, that'll help bees. And if you leave the seed heads up into the winter, then that'll help feed birds too. Yeah. Lots of things you can do.
Yeah, Jessica, thank you for the call and good luck with that. Thanks for calling. Ed is giving us a call from Harwich. Hi, Ed.
Good morning. I want to shift gears a little bit.
Sure.
And talk about monarch butterflies for
okay.
a second. So we've raised them and helped them over the last 3 or 4 years. The first year we did it, we raised and released 50. And then it's been a diminishing returns over the last couple of years, you know, 5 last year, and I think we'll be at 4 or 5 this year. And interestingly enough, one caterpillar went into chrysalis, I want to say about 6 weeks ago, and it actually finally emerged last night.
Wow.
sometime around sunset. And I guess my question is this butterfly going to make it? Is it going to, you know, will it be able to migrate part of the way? It's out there this morning. It's moving kind of slow. I've got the hutch in the sun in an effort to, you know, get as much warmth on it as possible. Its wings are moving, but it doesn't seem to be particularly active. So that's my question is, is this thing going to make it?
No. This is the issue. Do you raise them inside?
No, we have outside in a hutch, yeah, and they're all
okay.
They're all eggs that we've harvested off of our milkweed. They're not. They're all
native raised. Good,
that's great.
Yeah, natural raised.
Good.
Yeah.
You're doing it. You're doing it right. But I don't know what was up with this one, but it was not genetically predetermined to make it to Mexico for whatever reason. And you know, that's just that kind of variation is built in. Of course, they're not all going to make it. Under the most ideal circumstances, most of them probably wouldn't make it all the way to Mexico, right? It's like a little slip of tissue paper that has to make it from here to Mexico. Just the fact that it happens at all is so improbable and just such a mystery. It's too late. Give it a good few weeks. It's whatever, yeah. Maybe, yeah, but it's
I mean,
not going to,
should we release it? I mean, it just let at least get it out and see what happens. And if it takes off, it takes off, or is it just going to meander around the yard? And then, you know, at once its lifespan has, the clock has expired, it'll be where it'll be.
Yeah. I don't have a good answer for that. I don't think it'll make it. I mean, it's not
okay.
the weird thing about these forests in Mexico is that they're not particularly warm. They're going into these high elevation, cool spruce forests in the mountains. It's not like they're going to, you know, sip Mai Tais on a beach in Mexico. They're going to a cold spruce forest to like go to sleep for the winter. It's so strange. Everything about monarchs and that bizarre multi-step life history, different individuals doing different parts of the migration, like a relay race, so bizarre. This one slept in, and miss the bus.
Yeah, boy.
Fair enough. It was nice to at least see it come out, emerge, you know. I guess that was something to see regardless.
Yeah. Ed, thanks for the call.
All right. Well, thank you.
All right. Appreciate it. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll have more after a break. You're listening to The Point. It is Bird News with Mark Verity this morning. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Mark, a listener, says, more bald eagle sightings in Falmouth. Spotted soaring overhead. They'll stay year-round, right?
Yes. Yes. I mean, they've gotten much more common. They're breeding at least two, probably more places on the Cape now. And they've gotten so much more common in the surrounding area, like the state as a whole. Their breeding population has skyrocketed over the last 40 years and in New England, and they're still growing. And so, yes, every month of the year, it's possible to see bald eagles now. It used to be you kind of waited till winter and the period where the ponds freeze up a little bit, and then you get your, you know, that's the best time. And that's still the best time to see numbers of bald eagles. But they're around, and it's just, it's less and less. It's always a treat, but it's less and less of a surprise. I mean, I see them just, you know, I see them quite a bit. You just like walked out of the building at Wellfleet Bay Sanctuary the other day to chat with the bird banding crew. And there goes a young bald eagle just...
Their size is shocking when you see them. Like,
yes.
You know, it's like, whoa. Way bigger than you imagine.
Yes, especially if it's, you know, even a little bit close to you. I mean, they're just enormous. They're so much bigger than a red-tailed hawk, kind of bulkier than the vultures. You know, the vultures are big. Turkey vultures are common around here, but a bald eagle is just a monster compared to everything else around here.
Exactly. All right, so we've seen tons of rare flycatchers over the last month. What's going on there?
Yeah, I mean, it's a thing that happens overall where we get these flycatchers from the south and southwest in the fall, however they get here, blown up by southwest winds or fleeing a drought or something. But it was just, there was this period where we had a gray kingbird, which that's a Caribbean. So that would have been a straight north shot up from somewhere in the Caribbean. They nest from kind of South Florida down to Colombia through the Caribbean. And that turned up in East Ham, but it didn't stick. A couple of people saw it two different places in the ocean side of East Ham, and then it disappeared. And then Western kingbirds were around. They shouldn't be here, but we get them every year. And there were several sightings over the last month. They have a yellow belly. They're strikingly different than the Eastern kingbirds that breed here are just a black and white bird, and they leave completely. They go to the Amazon. Our local kingbirds go to the Amazon. So, you know, instead we get gray kingbird from the Caribbean and Western kingbirds from the Western U.S. that would winter in probably Mexico and somehow end up here. And then somebody in Chatham was walking his dog for a week and seeing this funny bird every day. And on the last day he got a photo. And then about a week after wasn't there anymore, he sent the photo to me. He's like, what's this bird? And it's a fork-tailed flycatcher. Ultra, ultra rare South American bird. They do nest up into Mexico, but the ones that end up here, as far as we know, are these highly migratory subspecies that goes from breeding grounds in, say, southern Argentina to the Amazon during the southern hemisphere winter. And then, for whatever reason, when it's time to go back south to go breed, right, because they fly north for the winter and south to go breed because it's the other hemisphere. Some of them go the wrong way and end up in Nova Scotia or Cape Cod. Not commonly. It's an exciting bird, a fork-tailed flycatcher. When one shows up, everybody's coming. I remember when there was one at Wellfleet Bay in 2009 or so, people were driving up from New Jersey to see that bird. It's a South American bird. Right. Crazy looking, super duper long, forked black tail, black head, gray, pale gray back, white underneath. And he was just seeing it on the wires. What's that? But it was long gone by the time I heard about it. It was I could have just popped out. It was 10 minutes from my house.
You're like, darn it.
Who knows? Maybe it's still out there somewhere, but we're still in rare flycatcher season. There are still other things. We might get a ash-throated flycatcher from the Southwest. They often turn up somewhere, and they'll be at some sunny edge eating some combination of whatever grasshoppers and caterpillars are still around, and fruit, you know, things like bittersweet, multiflora rose. So, you know, rare bird season, we're still kind of in the thick of it. And so, you know, when you're walking your dog, maybe you'll see a fork-tailed flycatcher or some other weird thing.
Don't wait a week.
Don't wait a week. Get the word out. Put it on Facebook, whatever your drug of choice is. Call the Audubon.
All right. Jeff's giving us a call from Tisbury. Hi, Jeff.
Hello. How are you?
Good.
I have a question about a bird that I saw it months ago. So it's not a winter bird.
Okay.
But I've been meaning to call you. Last June, I think it was. It was at dusk. It was in Vineyard Haven Harbor. And I'm watching this bird just fly right over the, like, inches above the water and dragging its beak. And so after looking around the internet, it was a black skimmer. And I've never seen one up here. And I've been here for 30-some years, and I've never seen one up here.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know if that's odd or...
Well, it's a special bird. Always nice to see one anywhere on the Cape and Islands, with the exception of where they breed, which is like near Edgartown on the Vineyard. There's a beach where there's just dozens of skimmers. Yeah, it's the only place. And they have for a long time. But, and it's changed. There used to be like a place on Monomoy that would have some nests, and the tip of Plymouth Beach had a nest for a number of years. That seems to be gone. And now they put all their eggs in one basket, which is this one colony on the Vineyard, you know, kind of our southernmost. The Vineyard is our version of sort of southern beaches. They have ghost crabs, which are a southern crab, and they have nesting black skimmers, right? It's like the Carolinas down there on the Vineyard. But then they disperse, and you can see young ones. They often turn up on, you know, the barrier beaches on the Bayside here and other places. And they do get around as the summer progresses. But it's always a treat to see them. And they're the only bird in the world whose lower mandible is longer than the top. That's that's sort of the fun fact about black skimmers.
So fun watching it. No. I mean, we watched it for like an hour, and we're just like, what is that? It just kept going back and forth across, you know, it was flat, calm water. So it was just, we're like, what the heck is that?
Well, Jeff, thank you for sharing.
Looked it up, and it was, I'm sorry, it wasn't a winter bird. But
That's okay. But thanks for sharing. We love to hear stories like that. Jeff, thanks for the call.
We take all birds.
Yes. Joan is calling from Harwich. Hi, Joan.
Good morning. On the 16th of October, I was talking to my sister. It was her birthday, and she was out in Valley Springs, California at her son Brian's ranch, and all of a sudden she burst out laughing, and I said, what's so funny? And she said, it's the turkeys. They're chasing the turkey vultures, and they're running through the cattle herd. And I said, why are they chasing the turkey vultures? Well, there was a cow that was about to give birth, and they were there to get the afterbirth. And I said, how do the turkey vultures know that the cow is going to give birth? And she said, I don't know. Do you know?
No.
So you're getting stumped this morning.
Well, so they have a good sense of smell. Most birds don't, but vultures and seabirds do. And I think the more they look at it, the more they're realizing that, as often happens, actually, more birds have a sense of smell than we thought. There was some sort of flawed, I think John James Audubon was even involved in some flawed research that determined birds don't smell, you know. And the more they look at it, the more that's wrong. Definitely seabirds smell. I mean, seabirds see the trackless, blank to us surface of the ocean as a map of smells moving around on the wind that they navigate to food sources by. And turkey vultures, you know, they can smell... you can imagine what smells they're looking for, because they eat rotting corpses. But yeah, they're black vultures in particular have become a pest in the Midwest, and they have to kill them because they've become predatory, not just waiting for things to die around farms, pecking eyes out at the, just gruesome things. And so, yeah, turkey vultures, if you're a farmer, you don't necessarily want them around when calving is happening, but they might be able to smell that's happening, or they see the signs, right? They can tell that the cow's ready, or they've smelled other calves being born nearby, whatever, they're ready. But I don't know. I'm shooting from the hip.
Yeah. Good question,
Joe. As always.
Thanks for the call. Appreciate it. All right. John is calling. This says from Peru. Hi, John.
Oh, yeah.
Hi.
I know who this is.
Hi.
Good morning. Good morning, Mark. And
good morning.
Good morning, Indy.
Good morning.
Hey, I wanted to give a holler to say, hey, it's really nice to hear people speaking in English since we've moved down here a month ago.
Oh, wow.
That's really nice. And I have a lot of birds, and I have lots of bird questions, but that would take a lifetime down here. Right now, I'm looking at a rufous collared sparrow that is poking around
patio. But yep, you're in the mountains.
The thing I am in the mountains.
Go ahead.
No, I all kinds of great birds. Mark, at some point I'll get my act together and send some pics along. But one of my most interesting encounters down here was on October 12th in the busy tourist city of Cusco. As we're walking through the throngs of people that live here, I saw a tripod with a spotting scope, and I was like, "That's not something you see every day here." And as I looked, these two young folks had binoculars strung along around their necks and sides, and they were ready for the field. And as I walked by with my family, I stopped and I said, "Hey, are you guys birders?" And they said, "Well, we're guides, but we're on Global Big Day," which I this time around. And so we got talking a little bit, and I've since connected with them, a couple of young kids that studied tourism down here and are really into birds. And I thought some of the birds I've seen recently, in fact, a very high altitude sighting of an eastern kingbird, were normally down in the lowlands more.
Yes, they're on the river,
It made me think of the global connectivity of all, of especially birds. And I wondered if you might take a moment to talk about Global Big Day and its significance in tracking, occurrences, populations, and et cetera, because it seemed a theme that we could use these days.
Yeah. John, thank you for that. I never heard of this. Go ahead, Mark, tell us what it is.
Yeah. John, geez, I'd love to hear more about how it's going down there. I've been to Peru 3 times for birding reasons, and you go along some stream in the kind of cloud forest levels of the mountains down there. I remember being there and hearing a broadwing hawk that could have bred, in Falmouth or Maine or whatever, that went all the way down to the Andes of Peru to spend the winter along some stream in the cloud forest. And there, other things that go down there all the way. And it's just fun to see that. You go down on the Amazon and there's thousands of barn swallows massing, getting ready to come back north. You mentioned that eastern kingbird. They go all the way down there, spotted sandpipers. And the shorebirds, of course, whimbrels. You go to Lima, you see whimbrels and ruddy turnstones and these shorebirds that we think of as ours up here. But Global Big Day, that's a Cornell eBird kind of get the word out. They're always trying to grow the user group for eBird all around the world. And I love seeing that. I love seeing more countries coming online with more checklists. I've watched it happen in some of the countries I've been to for birding trips. And like Belize, for example, I've watched some of the guides that I met years back are now just like so avid and constantly getting their sightings at the eBird and making new discoveries. It's a really cool project, and I encourage people to check out Global Big Day, and and get involved. And it is a global world, is that soundbite me
yeah, John,
spouting
thank
nonsense.
You. Thank you for calling, and thanks for that. We really, really appreciate that information. Mark, I want to go back to this brown pelican that's been around since summer. And you mentioned water's still kind of warm, about 56 degrees. It's still hanging around the vineyard, right? And it's been all over the place.
Yeah, that's what I heard. I got to check the vineyard rare bird alert. But yeah, I mean, that, I don't know when that showed up, August or something. It was on the South Coast. It was in Buzzards Bay, and then different. It was in Eastham and Wellfleet and Truro.
Wow, making
around Oceanside,
rounds. Yeah,
Oceanside, Bayside, back to the vineyard, then the vineyard again. All presumably the same one. I don't think we have, you know, I don't think it's like changing places with a different brown pelican and then the other one leaves. So I think it's the same one, just sort of bouncing around. I can't think of one that stayed this long, but very unusual. A young one, no doubt. And I don't know what it's going to do, you know, in a month or whatever, whenever winter starts. Yeah. We'll get a week of winter at some point in January or February.
It's going to be like, oop, too cold.
But yeah, it'll have to leave, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Right, and then tell us a little about the winter finch forecast. I know a lot of folks looking forward to seeing finches.
Yeah. So, right, the winter finch forecast is a fun thing that birders look forward to it coming out every year. It came out in September, and there was a biologist who did it for many, many years, and he passed the torch. He passed away, Ron Pittaway, and now it's this guy, Tyler Hoare, which is pretty close to the hoary redpole, which is used to be one of the winter finches until they combined the redpoles into one species. Anyway, they look at cone crops, various tree, seed, and fruit crops, not just cones, across the boreal forest, east to west, you know, Alaska, Western Canada, British Columbia to the Canadian Maritimes, and, you know, down to the upper northern tier of states, and make predictions about what these nomadic northern finches will do. They don't have regular migrations. They just kind of move around in response to food abundance and scarcity. They move from an area of scarce cone crops and birch seed crops and mountain ash fruits to an area with good, you know, crops of those things. And so if you get a widespread failure of multiple food crops across the boreal forest, then we have a good chance of seeing red crossbills and maybe even evening grosbeaks. And if the birch crops fail, then red poles. And it's a very cool thing when they come in, because it's not predictable so much. But this gives you something to hang your hat on, that, like, maybe they'll come. And unfortunately, it seems like there are good cone and fruit crops all across the boreal forest that will keep everything further north. But we usually get a few, even in a down year. We get this kind of Nova Scotia Express where, you know, maybe they end up out over the water. If you think of a map, if you just end up out over the water from the Nova Scotia and you head south and west, eventually you'll end up on the Cape. And so already there was a report of a white-winged crossbill in Provincetown. And then Bermuda had white-winged crossbills. Mm. Bermuda, right, out in the middle of the ocean. So that's very unusual. Like, they, I don't know, they get them once every 20 years if they're lucky. So we should still keep an eye out, even though it seems like the cone crops and mountain ash crops to our north are better, and so they don't need to come south. We've at least had a few pine siskins have been coming through, and so that's like a streaky little cousin of a goldfinch, a seed. You know, these are all seed-eating birds. And so some pine siskins have come through. Maybe they'll settle in at a feeder somewhere. A few purple finches have come through, but it's not a big purple finch year. But
so keep your eyes open. You never know what you're going to see.
And then Bohemian waxwings are part of that group.
Yeah.
So they specialize in fruit, and we might get a few of those. So don't rule it out, but don't expect a big year was kind of the
Mark Faraday, science coordinator at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary, joins us the second Tuesday of every month. Thanks, Mark.
All right, I'm going to go watch these shearwaters.
Go for it. I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Burdery and William Coulter.